Well, how are you doing tonight? So glad you came out on a rainy, cold. Why is it that every Wednesday night it is the worst weather and other days are gorgeous? I'm not sure. It shows how much you are dedicated and committed to learning. And thank you. That is an assessment. I couldn't disagree with that. I like that. That, you know, there's no distractions of warm weather. Nasty weather forces you here to class number 5, which I've entitled this Relationship Matters, Self-Justification, and Inward Journey. Now, this is so super, super important because as we're understanding and learning to first live life inside the hula hoop, out. Live inside, out. Gather yourself, show some courage. Live that self out. Don't borrow self from everybody else out here. So we show some courage, some integrity. Live with higher values and personal convictions. Live from the inside out. Now last week, and I'll throw this interspersed as we go forward, you know, I do have a unique way of taking simple topics and making them complicated. I apologize for that. I do. It is a unique gift that I have. I do get bogged down in my own minutia, which I find fascinating. Others have quizzical looks on their faces like, he sure has taken a long time to say a very simple thing. So it is a unique gift and talent. So from living life inside the hula hoop, the point last week, which I bogged down endlessly, is that our emotions, we can trust them 100% to match our brain's assessment of what's going on out here. I didn't say our brain's assessment is accurately interpreting what's going on out here. I said when our brain assesses, appraises, comes up with a meaning, an interpretation, once it does that, it will create a subjective experience we call emotion. So my emotions will tell me how I'm viewing and perceiving and interpreting something. How I'm interpreting something will tell me about my emotions. These two go hand in hand. I didn't say it was accurate about out here. That's another story. But it is accurate because this is producing this. Now that's life inside the hula hoop. Because everybody normally says out here is producing my emotion. That's inaccurate. Out here is the trigger, it is not the cause. This is the cause. Out here is the trigger, not the cause. This didn't cause me to feel what I feel. How I assessed it and understood it produced the emotion. This gives us greater flexibility and greater responsibility to have control in our life and navigate our life without being a victim. Because if this caused what I am experiencing, the only way I can feel something different is to change this. I got to change everybody else so I feel better. That doesn't give much hope. So we're living life from inside the hula hoop and living it out. So, thoughts from last week. While living life from inside your hula hoop, did any thought or principle, anything from the last class kind of stick with you? Or did you just get bogged down and your brain was fried and you left here and went, I just need to have a drink. I have too many cobwebs. Anything make sense from last week that helped you live life differently? Take the personalization out of this interpretation, like don't say my mother is coming to visit me. Use different language, we will feel differently. Emotional freedom. Betty is coming to visit me. Once you use personal pronouns, it can, too many meanings flood and we have a bunch of emotions. That's excellent. Anything else? If not, that's okay. Did anything cause you to see your own life and relationships differently. Did understanding about emotions, what produces them, help you bring some emotional freedom? I hope so. And if not, truly, the two chapters I would want you to read on the class page website that are must reads, Master Your Stories 1 and Master Your Stories 2. Two different chapters that explain the principle that I sufficiently confused you with last week. Okay, so brief review. Question number one, we can trust our emotions 100% of the time because our brain accurately interprets reality 100% of the time. And it doesn't. It just doesn't. And there is a video already about this on this class that I want you to watch. It's on the webpage. It's a YouTube video. It's already posted that will follow tonight's material. And it's a speaker in a TED Talk, and he talks about how he learned instrument flying, get his pilot's license, and with his instructor, and they put a shield over your face so you can't see out of the airplane. You can only see your instruments. And three times in a row, he failed. He was going in a total spin because his brain kept tricking him, telling him where he was going. It was completely wrong. So you have to learn to trust the instruments, not what your brain is telling you. So if you think your brain is accurately interpreting reality 100% of the time, you have to learn to question that. It is not. You see what you see, but you have to learn to question, why do you think you see what you see? Because others may see it differently. So how we see it tells us about us, not necessarily about reality in front of us. You know, when I talk to other therapists, because I'll get a client who says, you know, I did therapy with this other counselor. Would you please call that counselor? And you all talk, and you can gain a history about me. I'm happy to do that. Guess who I learn more about? The therapist. Because I learned the therapist's description of the client may say as much about the therapist's experience of the client as they do my client, because I'm having a different experience of the client. It's hard for me to see we're talking about the same person. So if somebody goes to see a movie and they say, you've got to see this movie, it's incredible, oh my gosh, I loved it, then you go see the movie and you didn't like it. Were they telling you about the movie itself or their experience of the movie? Yeah, so you confused their experience description of the movie with the actual movie. Those are two different things. So that's what therapists do. One will diagnose and describe it this way, another this way. We may learn about the filter in each therapist, not so much the client. Now, I didn't say it was completely wrong about the client. There may be a shared meaning where our hula hoops and Venn diagrams overlap, but it won't be a one-to-one correspondence many times. It'll be a 10% overlap that we're talking about the same. I'm learning more about the description of the therapist and their framework, their glasses, as much as I am about the client they are describing. That's how our brains work. The more we learn that, the better we are. Because our emotions are real to us, we should quickly move to whatever action or behavior that our emotions are inviting us to act out. Doing so will reduce our emotions and make things better. No, emotional behaviors will strengthen the actual experience of the emotion. So it's okay that you have a fully blown emotional experience. I'm not against emotions. But be careful. If you immediately act out the emotions, you will strengthen the original subjective experience of the emotion itself. It will strengthen it. So if you can't control your emotions, which that's fine, to fully feel emotions, try not to act the emotions out. Do your best. You can fully feel and not act out. If you not act out, you have a better chance that your body and your physiological system will slow down and calm down and reach equilibrium, which is what next week's class is about. Reactivity, fighting, arguing, and why couples get in escalated conflicts, or any human being. Okay? Three, getting things off our chest and venting helps to calm us down and feel less negative emotions. know, a cathartic model, if you read great good psychology, we've shown that catharsis, getting something off your chest, cleansing it, and beating up and hitting a punching bag, actually strengthens the original emotion, and it's more likely that your brain will ping back to that. You're strengthening neural pathways in your brain when you're acting out all the bad emotions. And it takes longer for your body to settle down and get out of this physiological state of arousal. When you act that out and get it off your chest, you're just jacking your whole system up. Why don't you sit down on the sofa, look at your feet, close your eyes, and calm down? Because you don't want to.
We all want to act it out.
It just doesn't help. Okay? So don't do the catharsis model. 4, events outside our hula hoop cause us to feel what we feel. So to have different emotions, we have to change everything outside of our hula hoop to feel better. No. Now the outside is a stimulant and a trigger. We can acknowledge that. Somebody cuts you off LBJ and won't let you merge. That is a stimulus, an irritating trigger. But it doesn't cause what I'm experiencing, because that trigger has to go through my brain, and my brain interprets it, and I may take it personally and get really mad. It didn't cause it. I'd rather say it stimulated and my brain reached a preferred interpretation. I prefer to view it this way. It reached for category. Got it? Last, people cause us to feel what we feel. So that when we tell them what we feel and that they caused it, you're the reason I'm so angry. They usually cooperate and change their behavior to make us feel better. They're so grateful for us sharing. And then we say, I'm only telling you what I feel. Now see, that's the ultimate defense, because who can defend and attack what another person is feeling? So to say, I'm only telling you what I feel, absolves me of personal responsibility, and it's a perfect defense. It's like giving a testimony. This is my story. You can't attack my story. It's mine. Oh, well, this is just what I feel. I feel you're an angry person. Okay, wait, time out. I've also noticed in therapy, people use the word feel instead of the word think or opinion or perceive or this is my perspective. Because now if they use the word feel, it's indefensible. I mean, you can't attack what I'm feeling. Well, I can, because the basis of your feeling is questionable. The feeling is not. And how you're using your feelings, we might take a look at, because the motive, I think, is to influence and change everybody else rather than take responsibility. Right? So we're very sneaky, and we've learned how to use these words to absolve ourselves and make a perfect defense. I'm just sharing what I feel, to which I'm thinking, I don't think you're just sharing. I think you're trying to influence and change everybody else in the room and have a perfect defense. But I don't say that. I'll get fired. All right, I said I'm going to intersperse a principle every so often. This is principle number 8. I want you to meditate on it, and then we'll get into the heart of tonight's material. Principle number 8 goes like this. You do not need nor require anything outside of your hula hoop to be anything other than exactly what it is for you to be reasonably okay. You're inside your hula hoop. I close my eyes. I'm rooted and grounded on my own 2 feet. I'm loved. I have people who love me. I have God who loves me. In theology, I'm empowered by the Holy Spirit. Christ is with me. I'm rooted and grounded in who I am inside this hula hoop. I do not, notice my words in the principle, bless you, Notice my words in the principle. I do not need, bless you, nor require. I do not need, nor require the world to be anything other than what it exactly is for me to be okay. Now, I did not say I don't have preferences for how this could be different. I do have some preferences. I said I do not need nor require. So what we learn is I have wishes, wants, and desires. I'm human. I have wishes and wants and desires for all this out here to be different than what it is. Wishes, wants, and desires in a human being can easily, darkly turn into needs, demands, require. Wait, what happened to wish, want, and desire? I'm not content with that, so I'm going to turn them into I need this, I demand it, I require it. Do you see the difference? Now, inside our hula hoop, if you will meditate this week, take a little quiet time every morning. The world is exactly as the world is. Can't you be okay inside your hula hoop? Reasonably. Why does anything have to be different for you to be okay? I know you have preferences. Why do the main people in your life are required to be different for you to be okay? Why? They are exactly as they are, and they have many good reasons for being exactly as they are. If you need them and require them to be different, it's a deficiency in you. It's not a deficiency in them. You know the traffic on LBJ and Central is exactly what it is, right? I prefer it flow. It just won't cooperate with me. I can go out and stand outside my office and fold my arms in protest. I can shake my fist and say, I disagree with this. This shouldn't be this way. It's not going to make any difference. I do not need nor require to be the traffic or the world or the people I love to be any different than exactly who they are, because they have many good reasons to be exactly who they are, for me to be okay. So think of the Serenity Prayer just for a moment. Are you familiar with the Serenity Prayer? God, give us the grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, the courage to change the things which can be changed, living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time. Now, everybody has usually heard the first part of the Serenity Prayer. I bet you the majority of the people in this room have not heard the second half. Accepting hardship as a pathway to peace. Not protesting it, accepting it with open arms. Taking, as Jesus did, this sinful world just as it is, not as I would have it to be. That's freedom. It can be everything that it is because God is with me in a fallen world. That's what God incarnate means. God in the flesh, God with me, Emmanuel, in a fallen, terrible, imperfect world. Jesus entered it. It all was exactly the way it was. He was okay. Trusting that you will make all things right if I will surrender to your will, so that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with you in the next. You know, Reinhold Niebuhr, theologian, wrote that in the early 30s, 1930s. And by the early 40s, Alcoholics Anonymous adopted it, embraced it, kind of made it famous. And in 1944, this prayer was laminated, put on a small card, and given to troops going to D-Day. Isn't that beautiful? So I want you to meditate this week. From inside your hula hoop, you can radically accept everything outside of your hula hoop just as it is, not as you would have it to be. What's it to you? What is it to you? Why are you so attached, and why do you need, require, and demand that everything be different, including your spouse, including your friends, including your relatives? Why? What is it in you that would require everybody and everything to change for you to have personal peace inside your hula hoop? Good luck with that. Go lobby for change and see who will cooperate with you so you can be happy. I do not need nor require. I have wishes, wants, desires, and preferences. I do not need nor require anything to be other than exactly what it is. You can be okay because you're loved, you're cared for, somebody loves you, God loves you. You have your own values, you know who you are, and you're on an exciting adventure in life. That is enough to be reasonably happy. Everything else is icing on the cake. Now, to our topic on hand, which is so absolutely incredible that I don't want to mess it up. I want to keep a simple principle. Simple. I'll do my very best. Because this is so incredibly important about living life inside your hula hoop, you will be astonished and amazed. If it was a paradigm shift for you to realize events outside our hula hoop don't cause our emotions, they stimulate, evoke, but they don't cause them. Something in my brain creates and causes what I feel. If that was a brand new thought, then this will be a radical life-changing thought tonight, that from inside your hula hoop, depending on what's in our heart, can completely alter our own reality inside our hula hoop. Depending on what's a starting point in here, the tail will wag the dog. The tail is the motive in my heart. The dog is how I construct reality. Not my logic brain will construct reality and the dog will wag the tail. We're going to see, depending on what's going on in my own heart, I can create a whole story and a whole narrative and be lost in my box of self-deception, and I cannot see the reality I have created. You might see it, that I'm in it. I can't see it because I've created my own reality, which produces my own emotions, and I'm lost in a box of self-deception. So this is entitled self-justification. How we create our own reality and put ourselves, nobody did it but us, into a box of self-deception. So let's just think for a moment. There are two positions that any behavior can be done from in the heart. So it's not about the behavior. You know, a kiss is a kiss. But a kiss doesn't always mean that you love somebody, right? Can you see that? It depends on what's going on in the human heart. Judas kissed Jesus. Why? To betray him. So it depends on the motive in the heart from which a behavior is done. That's why in all good New Testament theology, sin is never defined as pure acts of transgression against a holy God that are external. Sin is never defined as bad behavior. Sin is defined as to what's going on in the human heart that produces the behavior. Sin is not the bad behavior. Because good behavior done with a bad motive is wrong. Bad behavior appearing good done with a good motive can be good. Depends on the motive of the human heart. So there are two ways of being that I want you to think about, which went with principle eight. Serenity inside our own hula hoop. You can have a heart that is completely at peace, and you're not at war with others. You see other people as people, as a person, with concerns, desires, hopes, and dreams, just like you, just like me. That we see them as a real person, not inferior, not below us, not above us. They have real hopes and dreams and cares and concerns in their heart. And we see them this way. I know I and my family, my daughter, my wife, my son-in-law, we love service people. We love waitstaff. I love the cooks of this world, the maids who clean the hotel room. I help them. I like them. Waiters, waitresses, people who do hard work with clean hearts. I like those people. I honor them. I see them as I see myself. People who are aspiring, who wish a better life. I like them in my heart, so I see them as people. When we see another person who has hopes, needs, cares, fears, as real to me as my own, we're honoring them and we can see clearly. Our hearts are clean. However, notice on the right side, it's a way of being. If I see a human being as an object, an obstacle to where I'm trying to go, or a vehicle to be used for my own self-aggrandizement, convenient to be selfishly taken advantage of, or irrelevant or inferior, instead of an I, thou, a me, you, with hearts and dreams just like my own self, and hurts and cares and wounds just like me, and tears and frustrations and joys just like me. Instead of I, thou, me, you, what if I see it as I, it, me, thing, object? If I dehumanize another person, I'm on the path to clouding my own vision. Do you know, and I know you do, this is nothing new, people respond more to our way of being with them than to our skill sets, to our talents. People feel a vibe when we're with them, whether we acknowledge them as a genuine human being or whether we just flatly don't like them. They feel it. Do you know, I have the challenge. I see 40 to 45 people a week. That's for 50 minute session. Now, my goal, I'm not all the time successful. Life's very challenging. My goal with every person that I come in contact with is to like them. I want to find something that I enjoy and like about this person that I'm meeting with, no matter how messed up, no matter what their life struggle is, to like them and to honor them as a person, as I'm a person. To have them feel the vibe from me that they're always welcome. So they messed up. They're welcome. If they feel a vibe from me that I don't like them, they feel my way of being. Everything I say, if I don't like them and treat them as an object, I think will do very little good, even if I'm sincere in trying to help. I've dismissed them and they feel like an object and I feel like the professional and I'm the expert and they're the peon and why aren't you getting better and stop wasting my time? Are we done? Oh, where's your credit card? You can go now. They want to see, rightly so, that they are honored and regarded and that they feel the vibe that it's fine, that they're welcome, that I like them. So people will respond to our way of being, and so will your children. Even if you're right and they're wrong, they feel your acceptance and regard for them, or they don't. They feel it. So most problems have very little to do with skill sets and knowledge. They have very much to do with acceptance of a human being just as they are and to regard them as a person legitimately. People feel it, as they should. Most problems are not a failure of strategies. They're failures of a way of being. So let's look at the collusion diagram, because you're going to get it. You're going to laugh. Let's start on the lower right-hand corner, number one, where it says, she does. Do you see that? She does. Now, this is a story made up about Tom and Mary, because I use Tom and Mary in every illustration. It's always Tom and Mary. Sometimes it's Mary and Tom. So let's just say, on the bottom lower right-hand quadrant, Mary has a list of things for Tom to do. They're married. Tom agreed to do them. He said, "Mary, I'll do it." But Tom didn't know that later that day he was going to get an invitation to play golf with a friend at a club that the friend's a member of that Tom never gets to play. This was hard to pass up. I mean, you pass this opportunity up, could never come again, right? Of course. Self-justification, but we'll get ahead of that. So Tom told Mary, "Look, I want to tell Bill, my friend, I want to go. I want to do this. I know I told you I'd get these things done. I'll get the list done when I get home." Now, Mary was a little suspicious. Mary didn't like this. It went against the grain, but Mary said, okay. So Tom really wanted to go. Now, later, Tom came home, and of course, understandably, Tom was tired. Tom's been playing golf. And he stayed later at the club, and they had a few drinks. And so he's a little extra tired. But he's had a really good time. So he was not so motivated. So, in the bottom of the box, Mary insists that I do as she asks. So Mary began to complain, nag, and badger. Now, Mary was breaking a cardinal principle of using negatives to motivate people to do positive. Now, think about that. So Mary said, "I need to remind you," of course you do, "of what you agreed to do, because your memory appears to be very short." So then Mary reminded Tom, word for word, of the conversation they had had previously. Now Mary, secondly, to add emphasis to her present point, which is what human beings do, she reached back in history, as some people say, women don't become hysterical, they become historical. Mary reached back in history for two or three similar events to add oomph to her present point. So when past events are brought to the present, people go, "Why are you bringing up an event 5 years ago?" Because we have an expert witness in the courtroom who is stringing together a prosecution case, and they're going to remember past events and dismiss other disconfirming evidence when Tom really did all those things. We're going to find the events that he didn't do because it's useful to the present moment. So she brought up past negatives about his behavior when he promised to do things, but he didn't, and she had a good list because she has a good historical, hysterical mind. Now, the icing on the cake was when Mary also said that this proved to her, this present event, that he really didn't care about her. "Obviously, you don't love me." Okay, we've just cross-examined the witness and prosecuted the defendant. We proclaim the defendant, Tom, guilty. Then she said this proved Tom was selfish, that he didn't love her, that he didn't care about her, and the last coup, stick the knife in, that she couldn't trust him. Mary, Mary, Mary. Now, this is the bottom right-hand quadrant. Now, when Mary says that to Tom, what does Tom see and experience? A person or an object? Mary's an object right now. Mary dug the hole pretty deep, but she did present a convincing case. She proved his guilt. Now, she didn't say she wanted to accept and understand and have a relationship with him. She said, I'm sick and tired of this, and I'm going to prove I'm right and you're wrong. Now, Tom, on the receiving end of this, sees Mary as an object, demanding, unreasonable, and nagging. So Tom says, I'm sick and tired of you busting my chops over this stuff. Now, notice, Tom did not fall on his knees, take ownership, and say, oh, Mary, you are 100% right in everything you said. I have no idea what I was thinking. Thank you for being the Holy Spirit in my life and prosecuting me and showing me that I'm an utter failure, because, frankly, that is the reason why I married you, that I'm a better person for you pointing out all my flaws in my life. And I will gladly rise up with positive motivation in my heart and go about the chores that I failed to do. And I will do so with contrition and humility with a glad spirit in my heart. Tom did not do that. Tom said, the mic probably didn't pick it up, but let's let that go. I'm sick and tired of you busting my chops over stuff like this. You nickel and dime me to death. You keep a whole list already. Do you write this stuff down? I told you I will get it done, he said with great emphasis. Then he reminded her of several times, of course, that she forgot to do things that he forgave her for. So he assumed a better righteous position. Then he said, you're too demanding and nobody could ever please you. And then to add icing on the cake, because, you know, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, Tom said, and I don't know what it is you do all day while I'm at work making all the money. I'm just saying. So by this time, the gloves are off, wouldn't you say? You hit me with a right, I'll hit you with a left. Now notice, time out. The trigger, the stimulus, are harsh words said to a human being. Mary says this. Tom says, wah, 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 back to Mary. These words, behaviors, verbal behaviors toward each other, enter into each other's brain. The brain assesses, I am not putting up with this. I don't deserve this. This is unfair. This is unjust. This is silly. This is terrible. This is stupid. Now, that entered in the brain, and the brain interpreted it. Thoughts, interpretation, which then creates emotions. I am so angry and upset. I am not putting up with this, which stimulates behaviors. I'm going to escalate this. Now, both of them went through that process. So then it goes up to number three. Tom, of course, protests. He's either got to teach her and correct her and prosecute her, which he did, or he's got to comply with attitude. Okay, I'll get the silly list done to please you. But his heart's still at war. This compliance thing, like doing those behaviors is going to win the day. I'll do the stupid behaviors and check it off the box. You happy now? Oh, I'm sure that would make Mary exceedingly happy. Not, right? So then when Tom does this, what does Mary see? She sees Tom as an object too. She sees him as self-centered, inconsiderate, and immature. Now, isn't this interesting? Yes, Billy, it is. Right now the crowd is saying, give us Barabbas from... at least the females are saying, crucify him, give us Barabbas. I'm just saying. Way to put yourself on the cross. I have a unique gift of that. Maybe you do too. So here's the collusion box. Happens every day in my office. Happens every day. Doesn't disturb me. Doesn't freak me out. It's what human beings do. The collusion box is, if you act contrary to what your good-hearted motives tell you you should do to treat another human being with dignity and respect and see them as having wants, needs, and desires just like you yourself, if you treat them as an object, you betray yourself. You betray something deep inside of you. You violate. You treat them as an object. Number two, you begin to see the world in such a way that then justifies your own self-betrayal and wrongdoing. We're going to see this in a minute more dramatically. So think of this. The word justify, just for a moment, the word justify, if you think of it in a non-theological, but you can think of it in a theological sense because it kind of means the same thing. If you're a carpenter or a building contractor and the wall is crooked, it has to get justified. Does that make sense? You have to make it straight. Now think, if in my heart I do a crooked thing, a bad behavior, and I betray myself and I treat somebody else badly, I either have to own it 100% and say, I'm sorry, that was wrong, that was my bad in me. I am so sorry. Nobody made me do that. I could do better. I need to take a look at that. I don't know where that came from. That was my fault. I have a complete ownership. Did you follow that? I'm justified now. I made a crooked thing straight because I owned it. I said, I'm really sorry, and it was my fault. You didn't make me do that. It is not your fault. I can't blame you for that. I cannot find fault with you. That was all on me. Is my heart at peace? Yes. I'm making a crooked thing straight by owning it, which I should. Still with me? If I don't own it, how now do I have to make a crooked thing straight? I have to come up with self-justified reasons to make the bad thing justified. So I have to alter reality to do that. If I own it, I'm congruent with reality. I'm lining up with what's real. If I dismiss it and come over here and I refuse to own it, I'm betraying something. I did a wrong. I now have to alter inside of me and keep the outside bad justified. So what has to change? Inside of me, I'm altering something and creating a story, and I'm altering reality. So I began to see the world in such a way that justifies my own self-betrayal. I didn't do anything wrong. It wasn't my fault. It was all about you. You caused me to be this way. Now see, I didn't own my wrong and say it was my fault. I came over here and made the crooked thing straight in my heart by blame shifting and altering and creating a story. And I can sell you that story. I can even sell it so good, you'll apologize. I'll convince you, you're the one who made me. So much so, you'll feel bad. Isn't that interesting? So then as I look through my self-justifying lenses, your view of reality becomes distorted over time and you perceive the world in a self-justifying manner. But I don't know if you're aware of it, because when you betray yourself, you enter the box of self-deception and blind spots. Because I didn't own and I altered to justify, now I'll begin to believe my own reality because I have to. I have to. Now the tail is wagging the dog. Do you understand? So over time, certain boxes, filters become characteristic of me, and I carry them with me because I don't even notice that they're there because I practice them so often. But if you get to know me, you could see them. So we call them blind spots. Then by being in the box, Tom and Mary, I provoke another human being by treating them like an object to treat me back like an object. Do you see that? I provoke in them, because I'm treating them as an object and I'm not owning it, they feel it and respond back in kind, and who do I blame? Them. Because I didn't even see my own contribution to what I'm contributing. I'm actually contributing to who they're becoming. Then I complain to them about who they're becoming and absolve myself. I didn't do anything. It's all about you. I'm taking you to therapy because Lord knows I've tried to change you. I sure am praying that Billy will change you. We need some powerful forces. I have not contributed to this messed up relationship. It's got to be all about you. Now think of that. In a human being two-party system, I'm having no contribution to how you are, and then I complain about you to you. I bet I'm contributing because I exist. I didn't say I caused you to be who you are. I didn't say that. I said I'm contributing in some way because I exist. So by being in the box, I provoke others to be in their box. I elicit responses that confirm even more I was right. See how you are? See, look at what you're doing right now. Unbelievable. My gosh. So the worse you act to prove to me that I contributed, what does it prove to me? Nothing, because I blame you more. Then I turn to everybody else and I go, see what I live with? See? Everybody? Denying my own contribution, I didn't say I caused it. So in the box, each person invites mutual mistreatment and they have mutual self-justification and they collude and give each other reasons to always stay in the box. So here's the collusion box. I'll mistreat you so you can blame my bad behavior on me. If you'll mistreat me so I can blame my bad behavior on you. What a perfect system. So by being in the collusion box, we provoke in others the very behavior we say we can't stand. And we absolve ourselves of all personal responsibility. And then they provoke in us the very behavior they say they can't stand. So people problems are usually due to self-betrayal. Not communication problems. But all couples come in saying, we're having trouble communicating. Well, no wonder. You're each blaming each other and justifying your own behavior, and it really whips up everything. No wonder you're having problems communicating. So in the box, every change you can think of is just a change in your style of being in the box. You're still in the box. So then this is the next step, right? The conflict spreads. Now Mary, on the right side, starts building allies. Right? Because Tom is immature, inconsiderate, and selfish, and she feels treated like an object. So Mary goes to the top box and calls Linda. Because Mary is hurt and wants support, so she calls her oldest daughter, Linda. And she says, let me tell you what your father did. You got time? Your father did the very same thing that he's always done. And Linda and Mary have a very tight relationship. And Linda is empathetic and desirous to support her mother. I'm not against support, but we got to be careful, because we're supporting sometimes a self-justifying, blame-shifting narrative. So Linda says, I can't believe that. I am not surprised. How are you doing? What are you going to do about Dad? So she has a long conversation. Then Mary calls Betty, her longtime friend, and her husband is a lot like Tom, so Betty and Mary get together and have coffee, and they each talk about Tom and their husband, because they're both alike. Then she calls Jeannie, her sister, and her sister in Houston says, oh my gosh, Mary, I'll pray for you. I can't believe this is happening again. That Tom, who's going to help Tom see? Now, in the meantime, Tom is building his alliances because he feels hurt. He wants support. So he has coffee with Bill, his golf buddy, and he says, you know, I came home from having a great day, and Mary just ruined the whole thing. This is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Then he goes to Pete, who's in his men's Bible study, because Pete got divorced from a lady a lot like Mary. So this lights Pete up. Pete says, I don't blame you. Man, I just couldn't put up with it. I don't know how you put up with it. Then he calls his business partner, Charlie. And Charlie just asks, why do you look so tired? Did you have a rough weekend? Oh, Tom's going to tell him all about it. You get it? That's how the conflict spreads. Last diagram, let's take a break, then we'll get to the heart of the matter. The choice diagram, you see it? We have a good desire to see others as people, not as objects, with legitimate hopes, fears, and dreams. Now, either honor this sense in me and treat people with respect and dignity and see them and try to understand them, even if they had bad behavior. Try to understand and accept them. Maybe they're having a bad day. Maybe something's causing it. Let's have compassion and understanding. Or I betray this sense, and I see this person through a lens that justifies my own self-betrayal. I treat them badly. They become an object. When this happens, my vision becomes cloudy and my heart is at war. But if I honor this sense, my heart is clean and I'm able to see clearly and I have no beef. They have no beef with me. All's going well. This is the reason prior mistreatments do not cause us treating anybody like an object. Let me say that again. If we've been mistreated in the past, hurt in the past, which we all have, it is not the cause of why in the present I'm choosing to treat somebody badly. It is not the cause. Rather, the current trigger activates the past injuries and mistreatments in my life and supports my self-justified choice to choose them badly. It's a support mechanism in me. It's not causing me. All my past hurts are not causing me in the present to be who I am. They are supporting my choice. It's functional. But this person will sell it to you as the cause. That all their mistreatments is the reason why right now they're doing bad behavior. Does that make sense? The two can't be connected. I understand they have sensitivities, but they're making active choices to utilize past hurts in the present to hurt somebody now. So in therapy, we say victims, people who have been hurt, over time, left unchallenged, become perpetrators. They treat others badly and use their past victimization to justify it. They're a wrongdoer and a perpetrator using their past hurts to justify their current bad behavior, blaming it on their current bad behavior. If this gets challenged in therapy, they're the first to say, "You don't understand." To which I can politely, humbly, nicely, kindly say, "I think I do. I think I do. No, you don't understand what it's like. I don't need to. I do understand what it's like. I've been hurt too." But to link these to justify current bad behavior is a perfect victim defense, self-justifying narrative. Be careful about victim stories and you as a friend totally supporting it. I didn't say you couldn't be empathetic. I couldn't say you couldn't have a kind heart. Be careful, because look at the motive of why the victim story is being constructed. You may be pulled in that they want to absolve themselves of current responsibility using past negative narratives, and you're giving support to it. Unwittingly, because that's what the human heart does. Take a break, and we'll continue and see how to get out of the box. Okay. So here we have a self-justifying heart. The top left-hand corner, Tom and Mary, each view themselves better than the other, perhaps. each view themselves as a victim. You treat me bad, so I'm a victim. Because the other person's saying the same thing. And I may have had bad behavior, but it's because you caused it in me. I mean, come on, normally I'm not like this. Just ask all my friends. Right? To which in therapy I say, yeah, your friends aren't married to you. They don't live with you. So up the scale of significance, the higher up you go, the more of a solid self you need to hold on to yourself. Take ownership. So it moves over to once you view yourself as a victim or better than or bad, but you made me be that way, it's your fault. Notice, this is super important. Your view of the other person has to now come in line with your view of yourself. You're making a crooked thing straight. So now you must view the other person as negative, irritating, stupid, less than, inferior, and they deserved it. Because you justified your own inward view of I'm a victim. If I did had bad behavior, you made me do it. If that's the starting point, notice ownership was not the starting point. You didn't say, I own my behavior, I'm really sorry, that was my fault, and I can't blame you for that. It was all about me, and, you know, I really own that. I want to be a better person. No, the starting point was a crooked thing inside must be made straight. Now, how it's going to be made straight is I have to alter my view of the other person to prove I'm more right and they're more wrong, because I got to make a crooked thing in me justified. Now, what happens, listen carefully, this is incredibly important. The smallest negative about the other person will now get inflated. So now you can use the negative about the other person to the other person's face, and it's a small negative they can't deny. But the trick is your heart has inflated the small negative into a big negative, which is in the human heart. So now the person must view the faults of the, I said must, as magnified, terrible, catastrophizing, and they must minimize their own. They have to distort reality. Right? So if you're getting out of a long-term relationship, one usually magnifies the negatives and faults of the other to put rocket fuel booster in their booster rocket to boost them out of the thickness of the relationship and launch their own life. They don't put positive fuel and say, oh, they're a delightful human being, very loving, awesome, incredible, talented, and gifted. They say they're terrible, they're borderline personality, they're narcissistic. They use labels, and they use labels, and they describe this to a brand new person and say, you know, the previous relationship I was in, they were a nut job and horribly crazy. Okay, there's some truth to it, but it might be inflated and magnified to suit a purpose that got them out of the relationship. I'm only describing what is. We have to be careful. So once that happens, the view of the other person is distorted, and their view of the world now has to match it. The world's unfair, it's unjust, they're writing love songs for everybody else, but not for me. It's burdensome, life's a trial. And finally, the fourth quadrant, lower left, they have personal feelings that match the negative filter. They're upset, angry, negative, annoyed, and bitter. And they feel justified in those feelings. But the feelings are being produced out of a distorted view of reality, which is self-justifying. The feelings are real. I don't doubt the feelings and their authenticity. But what's producing them is an inflated, self-serving reality. Got it? So you must understand principle number 8. Listen carefully. If a person's heart is closed and leaning away from you, defended, justified, and negative, your truth will never catch up to them. Never. Because it's not about truth. What's it about? A self-serving, justified, constructed story to prove they're right and you're wrong. You can offer data after data after data to disprove logically what they're holding. It won't do any good any more than a cult that says the world is going to end on April 21st and they have everything invested in that belief. And when it doesn't end, do they abandon their beliefs and say, oh my God, we were wrong. Let's just go on with our lives and be healthy citizens. No, they usually come up with another reason that they missed to say, well, we got two things wrong and now we know it's this date. Do you follow that? It's not about truth and logic. At this point in a person's life, if their heart is leaning away, justified, defended, negative against you, they don't like you in their heart. I tell my clients this, you need to listen. You can be Jesus. Love them perfectly. Care about them in your heart. They will crucify you and put you on a cross. Because that's what happened to him. He's the Son of God who loves people from his heart to save them and redeem them. Oh, Jerusalem, oh, Jerusalem, I would gather you as a chick, a hen gathers its chicks, but you would not. Right? And then Jesus turns to his disciples and says, Elijah could appear to them from the dead, and they won't believe. No matter what miracle you produce in front of these people, they will say, you know, when you heal people, you know what it proves? Not you from God. Only two people, powers have this power. God and the devil. So when you heal people, it proves you're from the devil. So now we have confirmation bias. They will only select data that confirms the bias they already hold in their heart. Logic will not penetrate this. The story is a construction that suits the purpose in their heart. They select data that confirms their perspective. They ignore data that doesn't support their perspective. So the tail wags the dog. The tail is the purpose in the heart wags the construction of the story. Facts and the gathering and create a narrative. The tail wags the dog. The dog, truth, does not wag the tail. It's not about truth, it's not about logic, it's not about accuracy. Let's go over this again. The person's story that they're telling you is not about truth, it's not about accuracy, it's not about the accuracy of the details, it's a constructed story which suits the purpose in their heart. All of your yes, buts, disprove, logic will not penetrate it. Because they have to change the purpose in their heart before they change their story. They're going to cut their nose off to spite their face before that happens. Because now they have said, and in therapy, I've seen it happen, and I warn my clients, once the person identifies their story with their integrity, their personhood, they can't change their story because it violates their integrity. So they now must deeply invest in their story because their personhood is attached to it and they will be made to look foolish if they change it. So they have to alter reality and all of your logic. I thought you were leaving that person in a bad relationship.
Well, you know, all marriages have problems and I've discovered God's will and I am deeply more invested than I ever was.
Whoa, 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 whoa. You know, for the last 3 years, you have been saying this and this and this. It's interesting. It's not about truth and logic. It's about the purpose in the heart that selects the data that sells it and constructs it as truth. Ask any attorney. I love meeting with my attorneys, especially litigators. I love these guys. and women. They say, they tell me, it happens every day in my office, the closest story we have to the truth and accuracy is usually the first story the client tells when they come into their office. And it's not completely true. It's closest. From that day on, they're manipulating the details and changing it up. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. I don't have time, but listen to me. What I want you to see on the spiritual journey, especially in the Old and New Testament, whether you've ever understood this or not, much of the data, especially in the New Testament, is about the openness and closeness of the heart to receive communication. The openness and closeness of the human heart. So in Numbers 12, God says this, to the nation I speak through the prophets. To the prophets, I speak through dreams and visions. But to Moses, I speak face to face. Why? Because Moses is described as an open-hearted, humble seeker, humble human being, to which God can speak face to face. The prophets and the nation have hardened, obtuse, self-justifying, stiff-necked hearts. He can't speak directly to a hardened, threatened heart. Make sense? So in the New Testament, Jesus comes on the scene and Matthew and Mark quote Isaiah, speak to these people in parables. Don't speak directly. Tell them stories. Why? You can't speak directly to a threatened human heart that has constructed a negative narrative. You can't speak directly because the ground is hardened. It won't receive the seed. You have to speak indirectly because it's a threatened human heart. You tell stories out here. You can't go direct. They won't receive it. The seed falls on rocky soil. It won't take root. There's a sower who has seed. This is about the openness and closeness of the heart. The more threatened the human heart is, do not speak directly to that human being. Speak sideways. Take the threat off. When Nathan confronts David in his sin with Bathsheba, does he go into him and say, hey, I'm a prophet, you sinned, you broke at least three of the major commandments, you're guilty, God told me that, repent. Does he do that? What does he do? Oh, he tells him a story. There was a man who had a little lamb. It was his favorite lamb. He fed the lamb. He went to bed with the lamb. He treated it like his little daughter. His rich neighbor had all these sheep, but when a guest came, he went and stole that little lamb, his precious lamb of the poor guy, and slaughtered it to feed his guest. David hears it and says, that's horrible. Who is that guy? That would be you. David saw himself in the story because it was put out here. So in my therapy office, sometimes I say to my clients who are highly threatened, who are having struggles, imagine I have an imaginary whiteboard. Now notice, we are all looking at the whiteboard. You understand? I'm not looking directly going, hey, I think you're self-justifying and you're creating a self-justifying narrative and you're in the box of your own self-deception. Can you see it? I can. Duh. No. I've got to partner with, deflect the threat, put it out here on the whiteboard for us all to look at. What if, could it be, is it possible? Could we possibly think about this out here? I have to remove the threat. What if, maybe? Could be wrong. Could we consider this and let them struggle? If I go direct, seed falls on rocky soil and bounces right off. Make sense? So, if a person's heart is leaning away from you, defended, justified, and negative, your truth will not catch up because the tail is wagging the dog. And here's what I say in therapy, and now you're going to get it. The cause is not the cause unless you make the cause the cause. The cause of your behavior is not really the cause until you make the cause the cause. That person who came in and didn't speak to me and snubbed me made me so angry. Really? That was the cause of your anger feelings? The cause is not really the cause. That didn't cause it. But you made it the cause. Now it's the cause. It wasn't the cause. The cause is not the cause until you made the cause the cause. It's not the real cause. You constructed the cause and blamed it on that. You're denying yourself of all personal responsibility. You get it? The cause is not the cause unless you make the cause the cause. Because of the one of the things he does. Thanks. All right, so we're almost out, but you have to watch a little 4-minute video in this next slide. This says, once people, I'm not going to read the first two paragraphs. The final paragraph on this slide is worth everything. The self is ruled by a totalitarian ego that ruthlessly destroys information it doesn't want to hear. Thus, the relationship history is written and rewritten to justify a person's actions and to make them look good and feel good about themselves. So couples may sit in my office and one of them says, you know, I don't think I've ever loved this person. Yes, they did. They're looking backwards now, rewriting history to justify their current position. And when their partner hears this, the sad thing is they realize it's a construction used to be condemn and justify, condemn the relationship and the other person and justify their own behavior. It's distorted. Now, this little video is somewhat annoying. It's 4 minutes, but it's cute. And at the end, you're going to get the idea of the psychology that says to solve cognitive dissonance in a person's brain, I'm a good person, but I just did a bad thing. But I'm a good person. I work in pulmonary ER treating people with lung cancer, but I smoke cigarettes because I have stress in my life, and it won't happen to me. People resolve dissonance by creating a brand new story.
I'm holding in my head several different attitudes on one hand. I'm great and smart and nice and can't be fooled. But though there's also some other things that kind of prove that I made a dumb choice and now it's uh-oh boo-hoo. It makes me uncomfortable and inconsistent, and it's a thing called cognitive dissonance. It makes me uncomfortable and inconsistent, and it's a thing called cognitive dissonance. My team lost, but I'm no joke.
Dissonance.
I know cigarettes kill, but I'm gonna smoke.
Dissonance.
I got dumped, but I'm the best. I am a genius, but I failed the test. I hate boot camp, but I want to be a Marine. The fox wanted grapes, but he couldn't reach. What will I do? What will I? Will I do? What will we? What will we do? What will we do? What will we? What will we do? What will we do? What will we? What will we do? What will we do? Self-justification just to bridge the gap so that my dumb inconsistencies don't turn to traps. That might make me look or feel like less of a human being who is dumb, ignorant, weak, and not worth seeing. Dumb, ignorant, weak, and not worth seeing. Dumb, ignorant, weak, and not worth seeing. Well, might seem lost, but it's okay. I didn't really care about it anyway.
Justify.
My teammates played their very worst game. It's not my fault, they're all to blame.
Justify.
They say smoking kills, but I'm not a believer. It's just, oh, so good of a stress reliever.
Justify.
And it might kill me, but oh, whatever, because I know that I can quit whenever. She went and dumped me after only one day, but that's okay with me because I'm freaking great. She must have something wrong with her romantic taste. I'm way too good for her anyway. Cognitive dissonance is no mental alibi. We'll fix this mental dissonance by self-justifying. Cognitive dissonance is no mental alibi. We'll fix this mental dissonance by self-justifying. I am a genius, but I failed my test. Guess what? It's all because my teacher hates my guts.
Justified!
And not to mention, I'm a bad test taker, and this here subject's by far my least favorite.
Justified!
Boot camp's tough, but I wanna join the Marines, so I will go through hell and pain if this is what it means.
Justified!
To be a part of an elite group of tough guys, it builds character to shout Semper Fi.
Justified!
Fox wanted grapes, but he couldn't reach. He said, screw this, I'll just go have a peach.
Justified!
And I never really cared all that much for grapes. I think I prefer rabbits anyway.
Justified!
If dissonance is no mental alibi, let's fix this mental difference by self-justifying. Cognitive dissonance is no mental alibi, let's fix this mental difference by self-justifying. Cognitive dissonance is no mental alibi, let's fix this mental difference by self-justifying. Cognitive dissonance is no mental alibi, let's fix this mental difference by self-justifying.
Justify!
You get it? So then later, you have to reread the Genesis chapter 3 story of when sin enters the world. Because now I want you to see, after Eve has a conversation and doubt is placed in her brain by an enemy, is God really good? Did he really say that? He didn't want you to have a bunch of good things in your life. Come on, really? He's repressive. You know it. I know it. So she ponders this. It's a brand new thought. And after she ponders it, that's when she, quote, saw differently. After the conversation, she perceived the world and the, quote, fruit, forbidden. She now perceived it differently. I assure you, the fruit did not change. What changed? She did inside. Do you know an anorexic, a struggling eating disorder, because they're holding on to so much control over food, cannot perceive themselves as thin? They cannot see it. We can see it. They can look in the mirror. Their perception is cognitively distorted. They cannot see because they're holding on to a tight narrative inside. Make sense? So after this conversation, then the fruit changes. It's good for food, delight to the eyes, and desirable to make one wise. Then she took, she ate, she gave. Boom, boom, boom. Rapid succession. And gave to her husband who was with her. Bonus question. What fruit did she eat? Oh, that was good. In most paintings, what is the fruit? Uh-huh. Why? Because in Latin, malum, short A, is a word for fruit, apple. Malum, same spelling, long A, is evil and bad. So the fruit that introduced evil and badness is malum, because it's malum. Same spelling, short A, long A. That's a bonus question. Bonus question two. It says, she took, she ate, she gave, right? She took, she ate, she gave. Rapid succession in Hebrew. Boom, boom, boom. Where do you find these verbs in the New Testament? Last Supper. On that night, what did Jesus do? He took, he broke, he ate, he gave. The second Adam redeems what the first Adam and Eve could not do. Verbs that introduce condemnation, he now redeems. Took, ate, gave. No mistake. Lastly, I know you're hanging in there with me. This is too good to let go. Principle 9. The more we emotionally invest in something, an idea or a person, the less objective and clarity you will have. The more you emotionally invest in a person, idea, an object, a house, a car, the more emotional investment you have, or financial investment, the less clarity and objectivity you will have. Others can see that you're in a bad relationship. You can't see it because you have so much sweat equity, you don't want to let it go, and you're not going to make it turn out right. You have cognitive blindness you can't see. The greater the investment, the less clarity. The greater the emotional investment, the greater danger for personal blindness. The therapist can see it, you can't see it. If a person also voluntarily goes through a difficult or painful experience in order to attain a goal or objective, like hazing to be in a fraternity or a sorority, that goal becomes more attractive. Hence, some very painful relationships, the more one seeks the love from the person least willing to give it, the longer they will stay in. They're seeking love from the person least willing to give it. They're bound and determined to finally get it, but they will lose all objectivity. The Psalms to read for that is Psalm 115. The gods of other nations, they're idols. They have hands they cannot feel. They have feet they cannot walk. They have ears they cannot hear. They have eyes they cannot see. All who invest in them emotionally will become like them. How do you become like them? You have eyes, and you can't see your own emotional investment, just like a wooden idol. They have eyes, they can't see. Everybody who invests in them with all their heart to worship them will become cognitively blind like them. It's a principle. It's an ancient principle. So the greater clarity, the less emotional investment and more objectivity you need to have. So I train all my clients that I work with. I'm going to train you to become a clinician, a clinical psychologist. I need you to be very objective, not personally invested. I need you to collect data and see it objectively. Once you're personally invested, you will justify your investment by changing your reality. You're in danger. You have eyes, you can't see. You have ears, you can't hear because you're overly invested. How about with your children? Who can see your children more clearly? Teachers at school or you? So sometimes you go to teacher, parent, teacher, and you go, this person doesn't know my child. Oh, I assure you. I think they can see a little more clearly. My child would never do that. Maybe your child is the ringleader of that. So, we'll wrap it up. You can look on the website for the rest of the PowerPoints, especially about getting out of the box, four steps to get out of the box and have clarity. Do you see how important this teaching is? It's going on every day, and when you listen to people's stories, I'm not saying they're lying on purpose. We each create self-justifying narratives. We select data that affirm our starting point. We deselect data that disconfirms. We string it together. We sell it to others for them to buy. Let's all be careful with humility. Increase our self-awareness. Take personal ownership. See people as human beings, not objects. If you fail in that, take humble ownership and say, I'm sorry. You'll be out of the box of self-deception. Once we treat a person badly and begin to justify it, everything becomes cloudy, and now our reality is altered to justify our behavior. The tail is wagging the dog. See you next week, because we're going to talk about emotional reactivity, out-of-control behavior, emotional dysregulation, constant fighting, and finding the value. Why do any of this? See you next week.